Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Gloria, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gloria.
My real name is Morning Glory Marie. And that'll tell you a little bit about who I really am. I'm not Mexican, that's for sure. Not with that name. I want to welcome the newcomers that raised their hand and identified as alcoholics, and I want to congratulate all the chip takers. That's beautiful. You guys are the most important people in the room tonight besides myself. I want to thank Shelly for being so desperate that she followed me here. And I love desperate people. That means I don't have to do anything alone. I want to thank Chris and his beautiful wife for being such gracious hosts. You know, I got to see beautiful Portland, a lot of the forest. I love the trees. And I got educated on moss. So I'm going to take that back with me. And it's beautiful here. You guys are beautiful. This is a good group. It's very energetic. You were right, Chris. This is a big meeting. Oh, my God. It never ceases to amaze me how nervous I get. You know, before the meeting started, I went to the bathroom and I asked God to please talk through me, you know, and to tell you maybe something that you need to hear. But most of the time when I get off this podium, it was something I needed to hear. And that's how it's worked for me. My sobriety date is May the 2nd of 1982. And if it doesn't impress you, it's okay, but it impresses the heck out of me. And let me tell you, I'm a full-blooded Apache. I'm not a half. I'm not an eighth. I'm not a third or nothing. I'm a full-blooded Apache. You can't tell by my blonde hair. Apaches are not born with blonde hair. But this Apache right here is very vain. I've been sober as long as I drank, and I started drinking at 13. So if you do the math, it's 59 years. And let me tell you, I got a lot of gray hair to prove it, but you can't see it. And my stepson came last night to my home, and he did my hair. He dyed my hair. I said, I can't go with my gray hair. You better show up. He was there till 12 o'clock last night. And I went to bed at 1:30, and I got up at 3 to be here, to get the plane, be here at 8:30. And it's been wonderful. Like I said, I didn't lose my train of thought either, okay? I didn't have a senior moment either. I'm just trying to catch my breath. I'm overwhelmed. You know, since I've been sober, what I've learned is to be consistent. To be consistent, to be on time, when I make a commitment, to keep my commitment. You know, when I got sober, they weren't as nice as we are today, you know. Sponsors are very nice today. I'm not, but other sponsors are. My sponsor's not nice. When my sponsor said, you be there at 6 o'clock, it didn't mean 6:01. You know, and if I wasn't there at 6 o'clock, she was gone. And if I asked her, where are we going? She'd say, you don't need to go if you need to know. You know, so I never asked questions. You know, I got sober in Burbank with a lot of dinosaurs. And boy, they really taught me a lot. And what I'm doing right now is avoiding telling you what it was like. I was, like I said, I was born on a reservation, and my parents were neurotic. They weren't alcoholics. My siblings were all alcoholics, but not my mom or my father. And I hated my mother growing up. I was this little, and I hated her. I wished her dead. I don't know how many times. You know, I used to pray to God. On the reservation, we had a mission where there were Franciscan priests there. And I used to go in the church, and I used to pray to God that he would take my mom. And he never did, you know. So I started praying to the devil. And I used to tell the devil, devil, take my soul, you know. And you know, because I really hated her. She was mean. She was very mean to me. She always hit me either with a broom or a hanger, you know. But I never told anybody why, you know. I just used to say, she beats me, you know. I was a battered child, but never told you what I did. And that's the story of my life. I always, you know, like to blame people, places, and things. And I grew up real insecure. I felt out of place, you know. My siblings, they all had like red hair, dark red hair or brown hair. And I was the only one with the darkest hair. My hair was almost jet black. And, you know, I looked different and I felt different. And I didn't know my siblings felt the same way. But all I know is that when my twin sister died, when we were four, she died of pneumonia. And, you know, it devastated me. I thought she was asleep. And I remember going to my grandma's house, and I love my grandma. My grandma was everything that I ever wanted in my life, you know. I loved her with all my heart. And my grandma was always humming. She was always whistling. She was always telling me stories, me and my little sister. And she was always, I mean, she never yelled in the home. Never. You know, and I loved going there because she always had cookies, or she always was cooking and baking. And she had this underground oven, you know, and she had this dirt floor. We didn't have carpets, you know, back then, or tile or anything. We had dirt floors, and my grandma would pack it down with oil, and so the dust wouldn't come up. And she always had this little corner for me where I could lay down, and the ground would be warm from the oven. And you know, I loved listening to her stories. She would tell us these great stories, and I never wanted to go home, and you know, and it was always time to go home. And when I was 12 years old, we moved off the reservation into a neighborhood in Phoenix, and there was nothing but Latinos there, you know. And I thought, wow, I got dark hair, and I don't look really Apache, you know. That was my thinking, okay. And I thought, I can fit in here, because I didn't fit in the schools on the res, because everybody was older than me. I was always the shortest one, and everybody else was bigger than me. And so when I got to this school, I was 12 and a half, I think, and I saw these girls wearing tight skirts with the pointed shoes and, you know, the sweaters, and they buttoned down in the back, and they'd open the back up a little bit, you know, to show their back, and they had these big old hairdos, and I wanted that. I wanted to be a part of that, and I couldn't, you know. My mom dressed me real funny, you know. My mom used to make clothes out of flour sacks. Remember when the flour sacks came in different prints? You guys don't remember. And you guys never made tortillas or fried bread. She would make me blouses with the front part one design and the back part another design. And so that's how I went to school in the eighth grade. And then she would braid my hair. She would braid it so tight that my eyes would slant up. And I didn't look Indian. I looked Chinese, you know? And I couldn't hardly wait to get to school because I would unravel those braids and I would loosen them up. And because my eyes were round back then. And the kids made fun of me. You know, they would come around and go, "How?" You know? And because I was, it looked like I was the only Indian there because I was the only one wearing moccasins. And they would ask me if I knew how to track bear. Can you believe that? Kids can be so cruel, can't they? And they would ask me if I knew how to track deer and elk and whatever, you know, and I'd look at them and I'd tell them, "I know what I can track," you know? And you know, sometimes I wish I could find one person from my grammar school that walked around saying "how" to me, so they could say it again to me and I could tell them chapter 5. That's how it works, you know? And, but nobody has yet. Nobody's sober that I know from my past. At least not in this area, huh? You know, I grew up, I mean, we used to have, today they call powwows when all the Indians get together and they, you know, put these stands where they sell stuff and, you know, these big old powwows that you go to. Back then, powwows were parties. You know, they were like neighborhood parties. There was lots of booze and there was lots of eating and lots of camaraderie and lots of dancing of all types. I was 13. I turned 13 and that's when I took my first drink. My cousin, one of my oldest cousins, he was 16 and he asked me, he says, "You're 13, now you're a teenager. Put those dolls down," you know, because I had dolls that my grandma used to make for me. So I put them down and I followed them to the back of Grandma's house. And Grandma had a closet, a cabinet in the back of the house. She had a padlock that was really loose and they knew how to open it. And they had these little jars of kern, you know, the ones where they make jelly. And it looked like it was water in there. And my cousin said, "Take one." So I took one. And then we ran off into the desert like wild Indians and you know... When we got to their destination, my cousin was popping the bottom of his jar and twisting it, and you could hear that. You know? I love that sound, don't you? Every time I hear it, it just reminds me. And I thought, you know, and he just chug-a-lugged it. You know, like you do water when you're real thirsty? And he just drank it down. I mean, he drank like 3/4 of it all the way down. And I thought, I can probably do that too, you know. So I popped it the best I could and struggled with it to open it. But I heard that and I fell in love. And I chug-a-lugged it. When I got to the third chug, it burned going down and it burned coming back up. And it burned coming out of my nose, you know. That was awful. And you would have thought, you know, Gloria, put that stuff down. That's nasty. You know, but I don't know what happened. I didn't put it down. I kept drinking it. And then I don't remember. But when I came to in the morning, all wet, from head to toe, they told me we had a lot of fun. And I believed them. And I could I could hardly wait to do it again. And when we did it again, I was 13 and a half. And this time I took 2 jars. And the same thing happened. It burned going up and it burned coming down. And what happened is that when I came to, I was in a little room and had no windows. And I remember starting to panic and I came to and I'm sitting at a table sort of like this and I have my head down and I'm all wet from head to toe and I smell puke and I look up and I've got blood all over me and that night, I killed my cousin, the one that invited me to be a part of the gang, I guess. And I killed him. I stabbed him a lot of times. And I don't know what he did. I don't remember anything. All I remember is that woman throwing the paper on the table and saying, "This is why you're here." And I was tried and convicted. And I went to jail. And when I went to prison, you know, family goes to prison too if they do bad things. And I had an aunt that did very bad things. She killed some policemen on the reservation and she had to do a lot of time. And they called her the Apache Queen. And she was like about this tall and she had a flat top haircut and she was really buff. She'd been there a while, so she got really buffed. And everybody was afraid of her. Then I had cousins that were in there for burglarizing or joyriding or whatever. And so I was well protected, only when she didn't go in the hole, you know. Because when she went in the hole, holy, you know what, broke loose. And I learned a lot of things there. I learned a lot of good things and a lot of bad things. I learned how to drink vanilla. Ugh. Can't stand vanilla. I'll drink hazelnut, but not vanilla. I drank it by the gallons. Ugh. It was awful. It burned going down and it burned coming back up. The smell really deceives you because it's... because I really believed that it was going to be sweet, you know, like Southern comfort. No, it's really awful, so don't try it. I drank so much of that vanilla that it was coming out of my pores, and sometimes when I would run past the corridor or past someone, you know, some of the girls there in prison would go, they would go, hey, and I'd stop. Hey, baby, come here. You smell like a cookie. They would say, come here, let me take a bite. And this Indian would head for the hills really quick and in a hurry. And sometimes, you know, I would get away, sometimes I wouldn't, and I would get the beat out of me, you know. And I learned how to smoke oregano. When you don't have cigarettes, you smoke oregano with crushed aspirins. And all of a sudden, when you take your second hit of that cigarette, oregano cigarette, you start to hear bees following you. You know? And you turn around and there's nothing there. I was always anesthetized and I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I didn't know I was anesthetizing my feelings. I didn't know any of those things. I went to the psychiatrist a lot. And he would co-sign a lot of what I would tell him. You know, it was my mother's fault. She beat me as a kid. I never told him why. And so he gave me Valiums. He gave me Libriums. You know, and I was always first in the med line. I was the shortest, so I was always the first one. I would sneak in there. And you know, and they never told me there. I never heard Alcoholics Anonymous in the dining room. He never told me that because I was there was because I had gotten drunk and I had committed that crime. You know, nobody ever told me that. So I didn't know. So I ran with it, you know, I learned how to lie in there for you and for me. I learned how to, you know, do things that normal little girls don't do at that age. And I learned the good things, too. You know, I got my high school education there. When I walked out with four things. I walked out with gate money. I had never seen that amount of money in my life. And I walked out with... a certificate that said I was a cosmetologist. Can you tell? And you know, and I make sure that my hair don't go nowhere, so I put that mega hold on me, you know? Because I want to look okay, you know? Sometimes the wind might blow and blow it, you know, to the side, and that can't happen. It's called vanity. And I walked out with another certificate that said gate money, my certificate, my high school diploma, the GED, and the certificate for cosmetology. But I also came out with a disease that I didn't know I had, that had progressed to no end, You know, and when I got out, when I left, I was on that bus. I went straight into downtown Phoenix, and downtown Phoenix is nothing the way it used to be when I got out of jail. I was a week shy of being 18. And I went into this department store called Mako, and I bought myself a pretty red dress and some nice big old big high heels. I never wore heels in my life. And I bought myself the stockings and the garter, the stockings with the line in the back. You guys don't remember those. And I knew exactly what I was gonna do. I had made friends with women in jail, and we connected, and we're gonna go party. And they got me into a bar in Phoenix on Jefferson, and they let anybody in there. I didn't know that. I just thought I looked 21, and I had this big old beehive that I would comb my hair, and I walked in there with my beautiful red dress and started dancing to the jukebox and started drinking, and then I don't remember. And I did that for almost a week. And come Friday, you know, Friday nights is a big night in a bar. They have live music. They have musicians up there. Never heard of a dead music. And they have these musicians playing this music, and it's rock and roll, and it's rock and roll all night and drink all night. And that's exactly what I did. And I'm dancing right there in front of the band, and I'm dancing and I'm having a good time, and I'm twirling in that red dress that I wore for the whole week. Don't remember washing it. You know, I know that I had runs in the stocking, so I put polish, you know. You guys didn't invent it. We did. You know? And I kept wearing them, you know, and I'm dancing away and I'm having a good time. And then this guy from the band comes down to where I'm dancing, and he looks at me straight, like about this close, and he says, "God, you're pretty." And I'm thinking, like, I'm, you know, the best ideas I could ever conjure up. And he tells me again, "God, you're pretty. What's your name?" And I thought, should I or shouldn't I, you know? And then that big light went on, my knight in shining armor. And I married him a week later. A week after I turned 18, I married this guy. Because he promised me so many things. He promised me the moon, the stars, and the bright lights. And man, he was honest. I saw a lot of bright lights. It was the ambulance coming to my house, the police coming to the house, you know, the stars that I saw. You know, I was a battered wife, but I never told anybody why. You know, because when I drank, I had a mouth that just would not stop. I became 6'2" like him, and I could beat him up like he could beat me up. And he didn't like for me to call him names that included his mother and the dog next door. You know? Sometimes I would tell him that his mom had four legs, you know, and he didn't like that. So he would chase me in the moonlight when the moon was full. And he would chase me in the moonlight with a butcher knife. "I'm going to kill you." You know? He was very romantic. And that was the honeymoon. And then the kids started coming. One right after the other. I was like a factory. They're coming out. Before I was done, I had four boys. And you know, boys eat a lot. And that took away from my drinking. So I would make them a lot of rice, red rice, a lot of macaronis, you know, and stuff, and make a lot of, buy the flour sacks that my mother used to buy of flour. And I would make them lots of tortillas, and I would make a stack this high, And by the time I was done making the last one, it was down this low, you know. The boys could eat. And so I had to figure out how I was going to drink, because, you know, I was working, he was working, playing music and his odd jobs, whatever it was, helping some woman across the street or something. And those are the things that he would do, you know. Sometimes he would come home and he'd have lipstick, not on his collar, I won't tell you where, but... and it didn't matter. As long as I had my alcohol, it didn't matter, you know. And musicians love to drink, and they like to do other things. And one day he came home and he said to me, clean out my jackets and send them to the cleaners. And I said, okay. So I went to clean his jackets out, and I was taking paper and panties and whatever else was in there. And I dug real deep in one of the pockets, and I found 4 pills. Didn't know what they were. Had never taken. All I ever took was bare aspirin, and they had a white cross on it. I'm an alcoholic, first and foremost, but I'm a pig too. And I contemplated taking one, but my best thinking said take all 4. So I did. I ate them. And I cleaned house for a month. My garage, the carport, I waxed it. I got a little bit of mayonnaise on a cloth, and I started dusting off all the leaves off the bushes in the front. I waxed all the rocks that I had collected, you know. My kids, they shined when they went to school. You know, and you know what those did for me? It enhanced my drinking. I could drink all day and all night, and nothing would happen. And I really liked that effect, because I could drink during the day, and I still acted human. And so I went to my neighbors, and I said, Sally, I found these pills in my husband's pocket, and they really gave me a lot of energy. And she says, oh, I know what they are, but you don't want to go to those people to get it. I know where you can get them. And I said, you do? And she says, yeah, that's why I've lost so much weight. I said, oh, her house was shiny too. And and she says, I'm going to take you. So she took me to a doctor, and I got a prescription for 30. They were yellow. They were strong. Ugh. I ate one right away. And then I got this idea, you know, my disease is in action full. You know, I mean, it's just going. I have all these bright ideas. And this idea that I got when I got home, she dropped me off. And I thought, 30's not going to be enough for me. Well, really 29, because I just ate one, right? So I went to the phone book and I looked up more doctors. And I went to 3 doctors that were in the same building. And I got 3 more prescriptions. And I had a stash to last me a little bit. And I mean, that really enhanced my drinking. And I was real productive at work. I was productive in, at home. I was productive, you know, not with my husband because I didn't like him. And but I was productive. And I never cheated on him. I don't know why I never did, but I never did. I should have. But I was always a homebody. I drank in the closet, you know. I drank in the closet, and I kept taking those pills, and I boogied all night long. And you know, the beatings continued, and then one night I got this bright idea. I love those bright ideas, don't you? That always got me in trouble, though. And I got this bright idea. Him and I had had this big old fight, and he had busted my lip and popped my eye out of the socket because I called him a few choice words he didn't like. And I thought, I got to do something, you know. This Apache has to get even. And then I realized Apaches like to attack at night. So... When he passed out after beating me that night, I got this brilliant idea to go get a broom and beat him with it. So he was passed out on the bed, and I beat him with a broom. And I beat him till I couldn't beat him anymore. Have you ever beat a rug? Feels good, huh? Well, that's how good it felt for me. And anyway, I did that every time the moon was full. I love the full moon. It does something to me, you know? It just brings this anxiety in me that I just want to be productive and be... I like to terrorize people. And especially the him in my life. So I did this every time the moon was full, I would do that. And I would get rid of the evidence and I would throw them up on the roof, the brooms. And you know, my husband at the time, when he didn't drink and when he wasn't using the stuff that he was using, you know, he was a good man. He was a good husband. You know, he was a good father. So I can tell you some good things about him, a little bit, not a lot, because I still like to blame him. And, you know, one time he got really sick and he decided that he wasn't going to drink for 90 days. And that meant I had to taper down. But this little Indian don't taper anything, you know. So I hid my booze, see, because I went to Al-Anon. And I went to Al-Anon and they said, don't enable the alcoholic, you know. So I didn't. I didn't buy him his booze. I bought mine. And I hid it. So I would drink mine and take my pills and you know, be productive. So one weekend that he had come home, he decided he was going to cut the trees outside. Big mistake. So he was out there cutting the trees and he was whistling out there, doing it very happily. And then all of a sudden, I hear my name, and he's calling me out there. So I go out there like a good wife, and he says to me, Gloria, what are all those brooms doing on the roof? There are about 8 or 9 of them. And this is the story of my life. I've always blamed people, places, and things for why I was the way I was, you know. And I stood there with my hand on my hip and I said, those kids. They play cowboys and Indians and they throw the brooms up on the roof. So he did a good husband thing. He brought those brooms down, put them in the closet, and I had a stash for some more rounds. Only this time, I didn't throw them on the roof. I cut them up with a jigsaw. I had gotten him one for Christmas. Thought maybe he could build something outside, maybe a house for himself, you know. And he never used it, but I did. And I cut those brooms up in little pieces and threw them in the trash. And then one day I was cleaning out his coat one more time. And I found this bag. I don't know if you remember, the little sandwich bags used to come with ties. And it looked like brown sugar. It smelled horrible. I thought, I wonder what that is. It's rotten, you know? So I threw it in the trash, along with a syringe and some elastic thing and, you know, and a spoon that was bent. And I threw them in the trash, and the trash man came and he took it, you know? So when he came home, he was looking for it. And I thought, what, the brown sugar that I threw away? I went and I hid. When I saw the smoke coming out of his ears, I knew it was time to hide, and I hid under the sink. I had lost enough weight to fit under the sink. So I hid there till he was gone. And he left that night, and he didn't come back for a couple of days. That's how I lived. I didn't know that I had choices. I didn't know that I could just get up and walk away and not have to live like that. I didn't know that. I don't remember hearing that in Al-Anon, because see, I only heard what I wanted to hear. And I went religiously twice a year for 2 years. So I got all the information that I needed. And And you know, and so he came home to beat me for the last time. And he beat me for the last time and beat me good. You know, because I called him a few choice words and he threw me up against the table and I dislocated my back in three places and then he put his foot through my mouth. And when I'm in traction and I'm coming to in the hospital and I'm looking, because there's a mirror like on the bottom there and I'm looking at myself like that and looking at the people walking around. And I thought, well, I've been in Al-Anon 2 years. I can make a decision now. So I decided I was going to divorce him. And I divorced him and I won the house, the cars and the kids. And you know, I'm here to tell you that Arizona back then was a woman's state. You show a bruise and you got everything. I don't know how it is today, but, the kids and I moved back into the house on December the 4th of 1975. And, I always kissed my kids goodnight. I always told them that I loved them. I always hugged them because, see, I don't remember my mother ever doing that to me. I remember my mom pushing me away, telling me I was no good for nothing and that I was never going to amount to anything. If she could only see me today, she'd be proud. I put my kids to bed that night and I went to the closet and got myself my bottle and I went to the back bedroom and I drank till I passed out. When I came to, it was in the early morning, and my neighbor Sally and her husband were holding me, and they were telling me everything was going to be okay. And my ex-husband came during the night, and he burned my house. And when I finally was able to focus to the front door of my house, you know, to see what was happening, because I could hear the fire engines, and I could hear radios and people going, I finally focused and I saw the firemen carrying out little bundles. My boys were 11, 10, 9, and 6 when they died. And I don't tell you that so you can feel sorry for me. Because the last 5 years of my drinking, I felt sorry for me to last me a lifetime. Enough to last me a lifetime. Even up to today. You know, because there are moments when I feel sorry for myself. But they're only moments, sometimes just seconds. It's not as bad as it was in the beginning. And, and God saw fit, God has always, I heard it this morning, God's done for me what I've never been able to do for myself. And he did for me that night. I became catatonic. And I was in a hospital on 24th and Van Buren in Phoenix for close to 11 months. When I came to, the first thought that came into my mind was, is this my punishment for what I did when I was 13 and a half? Are you punishing me, God? I hate you, God. I don't want nothing to do with you, God. And I set out to do damage, you know? And the beautiful people in Arizona, the Al-Anons, that I deceived so much, at least I thought I deceived them. I reeked of alcohol all the time. And they came to the hospital when they found out that I had come too. And they got together and they sent me out to beautiful California. You know, they got me a plane ticket. See, because the insurance wasn't going to pay us anything. He went to jail. He got out of jail because my mother-in-law, my ex-mother-in-law, bailed him out, put up her house and bailed him out. And then he committed suicide because he couldn't live with the fact of what he had done, you know. And I used to say that it wasn't my fault. I had nothing to do with it. And I blamed myself for those last five years. I blamed myself because if I hadn't drank that night, my kids would be alive. But see, because of you and Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to find out how they died. Because for 5 years, I carried them on the back of my neck. I could hear them screaming, Mommy, Mommy, help me. And that wasn't true. That was all in my mind. That was all my thinking, my best thinking, my disease called alcoholism. And I came out here to start that new life. And I got myself... I came to this Italian home. I didn't know her from Adam. She didn't know me, nothing. I mean, how could she let a stranger in her home? But these Al-Anons and alcoholics sent me out there, and so she was going to help me. And I remember getting off that plane. I could hardly wait to open up my suitcase because I had a fifth of whiskey in there. And I wanted that drink because they didn't give me enough on the plane. They used to give you those little bottles. Not enough. Not even for a toothache. And I wanted that drink because I didn't want to feel anymore. I wanted out into oblivion. I wanted to die, but I wanted, you know, I thought suicide, and I tried a couple of times and never succeeded. And anyway, when I got to this lady's home, just as I'm popping that bottle from the bottom and twisting that cap and listening to that, you know, she comes barging into the room and she says, "Dinner served, come and eat." So I tie that little bottle back, it was a fifth, and put it back in my suitcase and went to the table. And she had a big table and she had all kinds of Italian food. I had eaten Italian food, you know, canned ravioli and canned spaghetti and stuff like that, but never seen a setting like that, only in the movies. And then she came out of the kitchen and she was holding this big old bottle. I mean, she had three kids of her own. They were teenagers. Some of them were teenagers, and one was like about 10. And she comes out with this big old bottle of Spagnata, and I thought, dinner is served. And when I came to, I'm sitting on a recliner with my bottle between my legs. It had that much in it, and she's laying on the couch, sprawled on the couch, with her bottle next to her and her glass in her hand, and she wasn't spilling it. She's a real alcoholic, you know? I mean, she had it like this, but she wouldn't let go of it. And I looked at her and I thought, what a lush, you know? Never looking at myself, always looking at everybody else. And I went to my room and I drank the rest of it on the way to my room and I went to bed and left her there. And you know, and I got a job in Sepulveda at a hospital, and I met a lot of wonderful people, doctors, nurses, and stuff, and you know, and I drank all the time, and this is in the 70s, ladies, in the late 70s, and I don't know about you, but being a beautician, I learned how to wet perm my hair, and I would wear afro, you know, the big, remember the round afro that, what's her name? Julie, no, what's her name? Barbara Streisand used to have an afro. Well, I liked that afro, and I used to wear the suits like her, too. I used to make them, and I used to do this afro, and I'd wear these long eyelashes, you know. And this particular day, my afro wasn't too round. I had gone to work from where I was at, and it was like tilting to the side a little bit. My eyelashes, because I wore those big Sophia Loren glasses. Remember those ladies? So, no, you don't remember. Too young. Anyway, my eyelashes would be like an L because the glasses were too... So I wouldn't take my glasses off. And they'd be lifting over here on the side because I'd put double eyelashes, the big, thick black ones. And then I would put some down here sometimes, you know. And boy, I look horrid. And then I'd wear those big platform shoes, you know, the ones with the instep about that thick and the heel about that high. And I'd look real tall. And anyway, this day I was working the commissary. I was helping somebody out, and I'm walking around, and this guy's following me around throughout the commissary. He finally reaches up to me. These guys, I don't know, you know. He comes up to me, and he says, "I know you. You're from San Fernando." And I lifted my glasses like that, and he went like that. And I said, "You don't know me." And he says, "Yeah, you live in San Fernando." And I said, "No, I don't." And he says, "Give me your phone number so I can call you." I said, no. And he walked around chasing me in the corridors, I mean the aisles. And finally I gave him my phone number. But usually when I don't like someone, I give them the wrong phone number. But I wasn't thinking too straight. I gave him the right phone number. And he called me out on a date. He called me on a Friday morning and asked me, why'd you take me out on a date? And I said, yeah, okay. He said, but before I pick you up, I need to tell you something. He says, I'm an alcoholic. And that idea light, that big light. And I whispered to him, I'm an Al-Anon. And we went on our first date. He took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. To the hole in the sky in Chatsworth or in Canoga Park. And it was a candlelight meeting. How romantic, huh? I was sitting there going, why did I do this? Why did I go with him? You know, and then he says, after the meeting, he says, did you enjoy the meeting? I said, oh, yes, very much. You know, I closed my ears to everything. And then he took me to my first movie here in California. That's where I went to see Barbara Streisand and A Star is Born on Roscoe Boulevard. And it was a theater right there. And I remember, I loved that movie. I don't know about you, but I really loved it. Not so much her. I liked him, Kris Kristofferson. You know, he was the alcoholic. He drank the way I did. And I thought, man, if I could hook up with him, we'd have a blast, you know? But it never happened. And but I really liked, I identified with how he felt, you know, when he drank and how he felt about his wife, you know, but I never felt that way like he felt about his wife, about my husband. And I moved in with this guy a week after I met him. Can you believe that? He told me he lived in Burbank, of all places. And all I knew about Burbank was laughing. Beautiful downtown Burbank. So I thought, I have arrived because I'm going to live in Burbank now. And I moved in with him. I took over his place and everything. And then I got a job at an aircraft company. And I got a good job. I had a podium like this. I wasn't a speaker either. I had a podium. I had a toolbox. And that toolbox, the drawer part were full of tools, you know, micrometers and scales and all kinds of stuff that you use to inspect parts. I never inspected anything. So I don't fly that plane. The bottom part of that toolbox had pills, you name it, and it had it. From Quaaludes to Reds to Whites and bottles of booze. And I had the best shift because I was the only inspector. And it was graveyard. You work 6 hours and get paid for eight. And a lot of crazy things happened there. We would work those first 2 hours, and they would bring all their paperwork. I would stamp it away, and then we'd have a big party in the hangar there. And one time I woke up, I came to, and it was like almost 6 o'clock in the morning, right before the supervisors come in, and everybody's running around because they're eating whites so that they can come back alive because they're dead. And I couldn't get out of where I was. I was in the fuselage, you know, where the gas goes for the planes. I was inside of one of those. I don't know how I got in there. I must have been hiding from somebody or something because I couldn't get out. I was screaming, help me. And nobody would come. And finally, this girl came and called one of the security guards, and he was drunker than a skunk, and they pulled me out. And, you know, and I went and I put my makeup on real quick and got ready for the supervisors to come in. And then I clocked out and went home. And that's how I worked, you know. And we partied all the time at work. And you know, and one day in April, My mother died in March of 1982, and I didn't find out until April that she was dead. My father died in 1975, right before my kids did. And he died of cancer. And anyway, this day in April, this guy comes up to me. He says, "Gloria, those things I brought you yesterday, they're not working, are they? You don't look too good." I was half dead. And he says, "Here, I got something for you." And he handed me a balloon, a syringe, and one of those elastic things. And I looked at that stuff, and I thought, "Oh, no. That's not me, you know." And I dropped it, got my purse, and ran out of there. And it was to be the last time that I worked there, you know. I didn't go back for my toolbox till 2 years later. And, you know, I left that place, and I didn't want to come back. And on May the 2nd, I was driving through Burbank, and I was drinking a beer. And, I finished that beer, and I threw that bottle out into the street of a nice street in Burbank. And I haven't taken a drink since, you know. And I didn't know it was going to be my last drink, you know. I didn't know that I was going to stop doing all those things. I used to go to Al-Anon retreats here in California. I went for 5 years, once a year, May, up in Redlands. And they never told me, "Gloria, you're an alcoholic. Gloria, you smell like alcohol. Gloria, you're loaded on something." They never told me anything. But I always managed to get myself a, I don't know if it was God or them giving me that private room because nobody wanted to room with me. But I always managed to get a room to myself facing the freeway over there in Redlands. And I would sit there and I would cry and cry and cry. And wonder where my life was going, and never knowing where it was going. Then I talked to a priest. I didn't want to really talk to him, but he convinced me. And I told him everything about my life, everything about me except my drinking. And when we were done, he's crying and I'm crying. I told him about my kids. I told him how I was an abused wife and an abused daughter. And he said, "God, Gloria, by all rights, you should be an alcoholic. You didn't say you are an alcoholic. You said you should be." And I just, like, laughed it off and walked away from him. And Monday morning after I had left that retreat, I went to the bathroom to wash my face. And for the first time in my life, ladies and gentlemen, I looked into my eyes. And I saw what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous, the reflection of God in my eyes. And I said, "You SOB, you're an alcoholic, you know." And I started crying, and I called that same priest. Big mistake. I called that priest. I'm telling you, those ideas get me in trouble. I called that priest, and I said, "Guess what?" And he goes, "What's wrong, Gloria?" I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "It's about time." He says, "That seat you've been sitting in has your name on it. There's a guy in our home group that says it has my butt print in it." And he suggested for me to do some things, you know. He said, "You need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I stopped in my tracks right there and I said, "Wait a minute." And there was silence on the other end. And I said, "The famous words newcomers say, and that's, but you don't understand." You know, I was married. I had already married this second husband. His name was Alex, is Alex. And I married him on Thanksgiving. Don't get married on Thanksgiving because you married turkeys. Sober ones are the worst. And it's not true. But I did. He told me to go to a meeting and raise my hand as a newcomer. And, you know, I didn't want to do it, but I did it. I said, "Oh, okay, you know." And I went to a Monday night meeting in Burbank, and I raised my hand about this far. And everybody turned around like we do at meetings, you know, and it was all about me. Everybody turned around to look at me. And Everybody that came up to me said, Gloria, it's about time. You know, everybody knew but me. No, I knew, but I just didn't want to tell you. And you know, I think that if they would have told me that I was an alcoholic, I wouldn't be standing here today. And it hasn't been the same. Everybody changed in my life. I changed. They say you have to change one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous if you want to stay. And that's everything, you know, and I really believe it. You know, I had to change the way I dressed, the way I looked, no more false eyelashes, you know, no more big hairdos, little ones. My life has really come around, you know. I'm blessed today. You know, my first sponsor grabbed me by the back of the neck. Back then, they were ruthless, the sponsors. Ooh. They're not like that today. You get sued if somebody grabs you from the back of the neck. This sponsor grabbed me from the back of the neck as I'm running out to get sober by osmosis, you know, at a coffee shop. At a coffee shop to boot. And she grabs me and she says, I want to talk to you. And I looked at her. She was Anglo. She was about this short. And I thought, oh, a newcomer. And she said, you need all the help you can get. I'm going to be your sponsor. And then I thought I had choices. I had this one woman that I wanted as a sponsor. She had long black hair like me. She had a mini skirt like I wore. She wore big old high heels like I did, low cut blouses like I did. She was my attraction. I wanted to be just like her. She had all the guys around her all the time. And it was the best thing that could have happened. You know, this woman walked me through the steps. She taught me how to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She gave me life, literally. You know, when she would tell me, go home and read step one, I would tell her, you're crazy. I'm not reading anything. But I would go home and I would read it, you know. But I wouldn't tell her I did it. And then I would call her and I would say, hey, you said to read the first step? And she'd go, yeah, did you read it? No. Mm-mm. And then she'd say, well, when you get around to reading it, write how you feel about it and how you can apply it in your life. And I said, oh, and I'd hang up with her. And then she would say, call me anytime, 24/7. So I tested her. I set my alarm clock for 3:00 in the morning. And I called her. And you know, you ever felt guilt? I called her and she answers the phone and she goes, hello. I said, were you sleeping? She said, yeah, are you okay, honey? Do you want me to come over? And then that guilt set in. Oh my God. I said, no, I'm okay. I just needed to hear your voice. Yeah. I wanted to see if she was telling the truth because she said she answered the phone all the time. So, you know, that's what I do. I answer the phone all the time, you know. Sometimes my machine answers it for me, which is really cool, you know. And she died when I was 5 years sober. But before she died, she walked me through all the steps, you know. The hardest step for me was step 3. How could I turn my will and my life over to the care of God who punished me, you know. But I did it. You know, not willingly, but I did it. And then when she said we were going to take the third step, I said, where are we taking it to? You know? And she said, we're going to take it on our knees. And I said, oh, no, I'm not getting on my knees for no one, not even God. She said, you know what, Gloria? My God's been real good to me. Borrow him. So I stole him. And he's been real good to me. And, you know, she grabbed me and she pulled me with all her might to my knees. And when she got me on my knees, she started reciting the third step prayer. And I started crying for a long time. And she held me and stroked my hair like I wish my mother had done. And she told me she loved me and that nothing could ever hurt me if I didn't want it to. You know, she told me that I could do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if I was willing to pay the price. You know. And, you know, and I haven't been willing to pay prices today. You know, It's not to say that I'm a perfect AA member, because I'm not. I'm not dead yet. And you know, I've had several sponsors after that, after she died. And I worked the steps with them. You know, my other sponsor was Patty from Santa Monica. She died of cancer. And then I had another sponsor, and she got drunk. I'm killing them, and I'm getting them drunk, I thought, you know. And then I run into an old friend. His name is Alex, and he goes to Los Amigos in Montebello. And back then it was in East L.A., and you know, he's a big, tough guy, you know. He's really buff, and got all these tattoos on him, and thought, wow. When I first met him, I thought, ooh, that's not the kind of guy I want to date. I like guys in suits. And don't say never. I've been married to him for a long time. And he's restored my faith in men, you know. I have a lot of men friends in my life today, you know. They don't want what I have, you know. They want my friendship and my unconditional love today, you know. I have a lot of women friends, and I have a lot of women that are in my life today that walk in Alcoholics Anonymous with me. You know, and I had a sponsor from the Pacific Group. And, you know, I don't know about you, but a sponsor from the Pacific Group was not my cup of tea, but I was desperate. And I got this woman to be my sponsor, and she says, the only requirement for me to sponsor you is that you have a commitment at the Pacific Group for 1 year. So I did that 1 year. I was a toilet paper girl. That was beneath me, trust me. I didn't want it, but I did it. And then when people wanted it, I tell them, heck no, get your own commitment, you know. And I did it for a year. And you know, structure is very important in my life, you know. I make sure that the women do the same things that I do and that I'm willing to do. You know, I never tell them to do anything that I'm not willing to do. She'll attest to that, you know, because if I do it, they do it, you know. And I have 3 beautiful stepkids. They're grown up. They're the same, about the same age as my kids would have been. And I have 2 beautiful granddaughters, 1 6 going on 16, and the other one 16 going on 22. And they're the apple of my life, you know, and the thorn in my behind. You know, they love to shop, but I could have missed it. I could have missed coming up to beautiful Portland, Oregon. You know, I've been to Medford. A friend of ours lived there in Medford. His name was Don. And I don't like to name drop from the podium, but he was my husband's grand sponsor. And we loved him. You know, he taught us a lot. He used to get the big book and say, AA works. I used to laugh at him when I was drinking. And but you know, it does work. And when I was 9 months sober, this man died in my home. He was a Cheyenne Indian, and he had the greenest eyes you ever saw. And I asked him one day, why are your eyes so green? And he says, you know, Gloria, when you get sober, and you've been sober long enough, you get rid of the poo, and your eyes change. I wasn't buying that one. And I asked him before he died, I said to him, what message are you going to leave the newcomers? And he said, tell the newcomers to walk slow, drink a lot of water, and read the big book. You know, and that's what I try to do. I don't like water, but I drink coffee, and I read the big book on a regular basis. You know, I sponsor enough women to keep me busy. You know, I go to meetings, I have commitments. I go to at least 4 meetings a week, sometimes 5, sometimes 6. It all depends where God wants me. If God wants me here in Portland, that's where I'm at today, you know, because God wants me here for some reason. And I don't say no to God. When someone asks me, I'm there. I reach out and say yes, you know, because my life is that important to me today. I want to live more than anything. I have a sponsor who has 39 years of sobriety, and she has a sponsor. And you know, and that's how it works, you know. It never ceases to amaze me how this program works and how, you know, in chapter in the working with others, the first 2 paragraphs where it talks about practical experience. And that's all I have is practical experience. Somewhere in the book we read the other day, in the back of the book, where he talked about self-insurance. And that's like all it is. It's practical experience. If I do these things, I'll stay sober. That's all it is. You know, if you're new and you have some doubt, it's okay. Just keep coming back. And you never have to take a drink or anything that anesthetizes you from here up. Just keep coming back. Your life will change, just like mine did. I have a life beyond my wildest drunken dreams. I do the things that I never dreamt of. You know, I get to go, I get to do things beyond my comprehension sometimes. I get to go to Cancun and take my grandkids with me, you know, and spoil them. I get to go on vacations like Puerto Rico, never been there, went this Christmas. You know, I get to do these things sober, you know, because I do God's will and not mine. But a lot of times I do my will and I pay the price. So don't do it. Thank you and God bless you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.